Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. NHL owners and players were back at the bargaining table the last few days, producing the greatest sense of optimism since the lockout began 82 days ago. Some of the details of the negotiations yesterday started to leak out via Twitter yesterday. Joining us to talk about what some of this means going forward is Dispatch sports reporter Aaron Portsline. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Well, good morning, Ann. Thanks for having me.
So you wrote yesterday that the talks had taken a hopeful turn. 24 hours later, are you still hopeful?
Yes. I mean, there's obviously always the chance that this can fall apart, and there's still a lot of work to be done. Some very difficult hurdles yet to clear. But look, for the first time, as you said, since this has started, they're actually working at it. We assume, working off of the same document, which is when it really begins. They're not just promoting their own CBA offers. They're actually negotiating hard numbers and trying to move toward the middle. Does this guarantee something's going to be done? Of course not. But it is. There is an effort now. You see the moderates on both sides really taking charge, and there's an effort now to get something solved here at what would probably be safely called the 11th hour.
Yeah, how does this compare, this bout compared to the last lockout and what happened when the season was completely canceled? At this time and back then, what was going on?
Well, what's interesting is back then, and I think we were all wrong a little bit on this, heading into this one, it was a landscape change. They were changing the entire financial landscape of the league by instituting a salary cap. That's already in place, so everyone assumed that this one would not be as difficult. Because you're not changing the entire structure of how the league handles its revenues. I think what is still the lasting problem here, and the reason that it is such a mess and such a difficulty, is you have in this league, more than any of the other sports leagues, you have teams of great wealth, the Toronto Maple Leafs, the Montreal Canadiens, worth $1 billion. And then you've got a team like the one here in Columbus, you've got Florida, Phoenix, other teams that are, for various different reasons, down here at a level that is so far away from the other teams. There's a great, great range of franchise values and revenue streams.
So there's different stakes in it.
Well, big time. And so of the 30 owners, you've got probably 22 different ideas of what the perfect collective bargaining agreement would look like. Certainly the players are divided among that as well, but you cannot make one business model that works for all 30 teams. You either, if it works for the teams down here, Columbus, Phoenix, the Islanders, whatever, then the teams at the top are just bringing in tons and tons of cash. So the challenge has been a way to sort of, without, the league has resisted meaningful revenue sharing like other leagues have, but as a way to circulate money from the top to the bottom, to bring the bottom up, to bring the top down a bit so that everyone is sort of in the same stratosphere and the money is circulating widely. The players want that, of course, because when money circulates, more of it gets to them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Aaron Portsline, sports reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. We're talking about the bargaining table right now between the NHL owners and players. They're back at the bargaining table. The lockout has been going on for about 82 days now. If you have a question or comment for Aaron, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Is the Columbus Blue Jackets organization better situated this time, given the change of ownership of the arena and so forth, than it was the last time?
Certainly they are.
Okay. I mean,
that has infused annual money to the team. That is going to serve almost what revenue sharing would for them. It's going to give them an annual a buffer, if you will, against their losses. Having said this, this is a very difficult market to judge because the team has been run poorly. Let's not kid ourselves. They've spent a ton of players. They were top five in the league in salary last year, but because they've been so poor, the crowds have not been there.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got their own private issues, but that money, the transaction that occurred about a year ago, absolutely beneficial for the club, and they're much more stable because of it.
I mentioned earlier that the lost games, the lost Winter Classic, the lost All-Stars game for Columbus didn't seem to make a difference that some people had predicted it would in terms of getting them to the table sooner. What finally made the difference?
I think there's a real sense that the season was going to be lost here if something didn't get done quickly, the entire season. The NHL is the only professional sports league in this country that has canceled an entire season and its playoffs. That was in 2004-2005. And the league has had extraordinary growth since then, from $1.8 to $3.3 billion. And what in the last 7 years has grown at that rate in this country? It's incredible. And yet here they were again at the brink of canceling another season. And that, of course, they could still be there. But I think that was the fear among the players, among a lot of owners. And I think you've seen a surge from sort of the middle part of each group to the top saying, guys, enough. We have to get something done here. This is this continually standing your ground and pushing it to the brink in the hope of getting your way is really destructive, and it cannot be continued.
You know, if someone's just joining us now, they might think we were talking about Congress or something.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
And this is the frozen cliff, not the fiscal cliff.
So who gets to be at those meetings anyway, Aaron?
Well, this is one of the things that's changed here recently is that they've selected – this started a couple of days ago when they brought six owners in and 18 players. A smaller group. They did not have the leader on either side. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman was not in the room. NHL Players Association Executive Director Donald Fehr was not in the room. You get those personalities out of the way, and you bring some moderate owners. Ron Burkle of the Pittsburgh Penguins is said to be very important in this. Sidney Crosby of the Pittsburgh Penguins is said to have taken a leadership role among the players. They began talking. They began, what do you need? This is what we need. This is why we need it. Rather than this, I'm going to win at all costs, and I will bury you, and I don't care if I take the game with me mentality that has seemed so prevalent the first 3 months here, but also the entire 0405 situation.
Michael in Delaware, you're on the air with Aaron Portzline from the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I've got two quick questions for you. One is, was there any consideration to contraction and maybe going down to 28 or 26 teams? Because it seems like, I mean, I'm not knocking certain markets, but it seems like hockey's obviously much more prevalent in northern states as well as Canada. And then my second question, and I'll get off there and listen, is how you think the schedule will shake out if they go ahead and do it. I know they all already canceled the All-Star game, so I know we're going to pack a lot of games in, but does this mean we'll lose seeing games against Eastern teams such as the Canadiens or the Maple Leafs, who we only get to see every couple years anyway? Thank you.
Thank you. The first question, contraction. You know what? It's not something that the players want, obviously. I have never gotten a sense among ownership that they're for it. If you look at the league as simply a financial entity, then I think it makes sense that you're rid of your weakest. Having said that, it's a very difficult and tricky business. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the Pittsburgh Penguins were last in the league in attendance. And then Sidney Crosby came along. They were last in the league in attendance the first year coming out of the lockout. And now you would have a very hard time getting 10 teams deep in the league, listing the strongest teams without getting to the Pittsburgh Penguins. The Chicago Blackhawks were a lost cause for 25 years. They've now become one of the most passionate fan bases in the league. Columbus is a market that has yet to be realized, I think. I still think it can be a very good market. They need a competent ownership group. They need a competent leadership group. They need better players. Let's not kid ourselves. If you saw this building the first few years that the league was here, I think you would firmly believe that this can be a very solid market once the fan base learns to trust the product, and they're still a ways away from that. The second question, yes, if they do settle the season, the sense is that they'd have somewhere between a 50 and 56 game schedule if they were to settle it right now. If that's the case, I think there would be very few, if any, games intra-conference. I think it would all be inter-conference. I think you'd see Columbus playing only Western teams as a way to sort that out heading into the playoffs.
We have an email from Jason. He writes, I am really disappointed that the All-Star game was canceled. Columbus just can't win when it comes to hockey. Will we get the All-Star game next year?
There's almost no chance that they get it next year. In years when there is an Olympics, and next year the Olympics are in Sochi, Russia, the NHL sends their players to the Olympics. They do not have an All-Star game that year. That is something to be collectively bargained. So they are negotiating whether the players will go to the Olympics each year. But both sides really like that. I cannot imagine a situation where the players don't go to the Olympics. So the best bet for Columbus would be 2015. Nothing is official on that. But Sherrod Brown is involved now. The Blue Jackets are involved. The league's not, frankly, listening or worried about the 2015 All-Star game just yet. They've got bigger things.
Wait a minute. They've got a U.S. senator involved in this?
Sherrod Brown, yeah, has reached out and is helping, said he is going to help the cause to bring the game back here in 2015. I don't know, frankly, that there's much work that's needed to be done toward that. I think the league is very receptive to having the game here. But 2015 does look like the next opportunity. And I don't think anyone can say at this point, but the sense I get is that the league would like to honor the game in Columbus as soon as possible. And the previous times that they've canceled the All-Star game because of the lockout, isn't this ridiculous? The history that this league has, they have a lot of they have had a lot of practice at canceling All-Star games, but each time they have awarded the game to the city within the next few years.
Yeah, so they don't schedule these things out like the Olympics do or like the Super Bowl does.
Usually 2 years out, not 8-10 years out, yeah.
Hey, you said that if any semblance of a season is to be salvaged, this week figures to be crucial. Why is that, and how crucial are we talking? Because I think in 2004, 2005, it wasn't until February that we all gave up the ghost.
Yeah, it was officially canceled February 16th. I remember in January around New Year's thinking, there's no way there's going to be a season. And, mm-hmm. and people for a long time before it was officially canceled, they knew there was not going to be a season.
Yeah, but NHL, people like me still hung on to hope.
Dan, I can't imagine you had much hope even into February, though, right? I mean, holy smokes.
Yeah.
In February, you're talking 2 months left, right?
Not exactly. Either. It's crazy.
The feeling was that this was going nowhere fast. I mean, they had federal mediators came in and listened to them for 12 hours and said, you know what, you guys are so far away, we got nothing here, right? And they walked away, and that's a really chilling sign. I think that awakened people on both sides that said, you know, I'm not going to assign blame to one side or the other, any faction within our group, but this is not going right. Something has to change, and the dynamic that was changed was taking the leaders out of the discussion.
Real quick, just what's the absolute number one thing that has to be resolved that they have to work out first?
Yeah, well, the enchilada is how revenue is divided,
okay.
Right? The players want assurances that the Columbuses, the market, those markets are going to be assisted from the highest markets. And part of that is, they want the game to be healthy. That's the altruistic point. They also want money freed up to be spent on players. So that's been the big hurdle. And there's some other ticky-tacky stuff in there that will be minor hurdles, but that is money is always the big deal.
Well, thanks for joining us to talk about it today, Aaron. I hope the next time we talk about it, there will be some resolution.
Sounds good, Anna. Thanks very much for having me.
You bet. That's Aaron Portsline. He's a sports reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Coming up, Robert Mankoff, the cartoon editor for The New Yorker. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, 2012 has seen drought, wildfire, ice melt, sandy, and 70-degree temps in Chicago in December. What are we going to do about climate change? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point is this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. Sunshine today and a high of 48 degrees. Expect rain showers overnight tonight, late tonight, a low of 43. And then rain is likely throughout the day on Friday, a high of 55 degrees. More rain Friday night, a low of 48. Support for 89.7 comes from the State Auto Insurance Companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. American humor comes in a lot of shapes and sizes, and when all is said and done, it might be in the eye of the beholder, but the wisdom of cartoon editors for The New Yorker over time has been pretty much undisputed. Joining us now to talk about American humor and how it translates to squiggly black lines and dots is the acclaimed cartoon editor and cartoonist himself for The New Yorker magazine, Robert Mankoff. Robert will appear tonight at the Thurber House 2012 Thurber Birthday Gala. We'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to learn more about that. But right now, Robert, welcome to the show.
Very, very happy to be here. As I've been telling your producers and you, I'm at an Apple store trying to get my Mac laptop fixed so the presentations won't have to be radio cartoons, but we're going to have to try those anyway.
Well, the good thing about this cartooning is, as I was preparing for the show, I thought it's kind of easy to describe. I kept yelling across the hallway to my producer out the descriptions of the cartoons, and you can still laugh at them sometimes.
Yeah, and I hope they will tonight if they don't have their laptop.
You know the one about. I was wondering if, and I guess I don't wonder so much anymore after reading an interview with you, but I was wondering if you are the type of person that likes to joke around with friends and acquaintances. Are you a fun and easygoing person to talk to?
I don't know. I think my last wife thinks so. I don't know if the previous two did. But, yeah, I think I am. I mean, if I didn't, generally my mental state is either, without humor, is either I'm panicking or making preparations to panic. And so, like, the only thing that really keeps me going is realizing, you know, that, you know, it's not that serious. And I love people who just use humor in ordinary situations. I mean, I try to do it all the time as sort of this, just way to make relationships easier. On the flight coming here, it's always nice when you have a flight attendant who has a sense of humor rather than someone who's just, you know, showing you once again, in case you've been on Mars for the last 25 years, how to buckle your seat. This guy was saying, you know, finally the cabin doors closed, and he said, the cabin doors are closed. We certainly hope your destination today was Columbus, Ohio. If it isn't, it is now.
Yeah, there's nothing better than a flight attendant with a sense of humor.
Yeah, because let's face it, we're all pretty aggravated when we're when we're on the airplane. We had the late cartoonist who passed to Leo Cullen, was actually an airline pilot, and he had one wonderful cartoon which says, you know, the flying time will be, you know, 3 hours in first class and 12 in coach.
Right. I read somewhere once that you said you didn't want to give away any secrets about the cartoon business, but then you wrote a whole book about it in 2002, The Naked Cartoonist.
Yes, everything. I told everything, and I have a memoir coming out in will hopefully come out if I get my laptop working and can finish it. Otherwise, I'll just have to make an excuse to my publisher that the laptop ate my homework.
Right.
But coming out next year about my life in cartooning and talking about what it, you know, what the, not so much the secrets, you know, rules of thumb. And if the thumb doesn't work, we have other fingers.
Well, it was a lot of fun to read, and it's a lot of pictures, so it's easy to read.
Yes.
I read an interview you did with another cartoonist. He asked you what it feels like to be the man. So I guess he was referring to the lives that hang in the balance every time. I guess once a week you have what you call your art meetings and select the next batch of cartoons to go into the New Yorker. Do you feel like the man?
Well, I feel like the boy grown up. I always feel that. I mean, no matter how old you get, it's a great job to have to be cartoon editor of the New Yorker. You know, it's a fancy building high above Manhattan. And, sometimes I'm a kid from Queens, which is one of the outside boroughs of New York. I don't really have hoity-toity attitudes by myself, but when you're sitting there saying, wow, this is a great job. I remember when I finally got the job, my mother, who was always a cynic and a skeptic about everything, just actually asked me this about everything. She said, so they pay you for this? But I care very much about the cartoonists. Like every week we get to see about 300 or 400 cartoons from our cartoonists, our primary cartoonists. And there's about 1,000 overall, everybody sending in cartoons from people who've come in. Norman Mailer has sent me cartoons, David Mamet, Johnny Carson before I was cartoon editor. So everybody thinks they have a good idea for a cartoon. And a lot of people actually do have a reasonably good idea for a cartoon. That's why we have the caption contest where they can demonstrate their sense of humor. But for the cartoonists who do it for a living, who are funny for money, it's a job. So it's a great job in a way, and it's satisfying to do that. But the job itself of making jokes is not fun or even funny. It's something that you really have to work at because it's not, see, like when we started the interview, you said, are you the type of person who goes around? And you know what? That's actually very easy to do because people don't demand very much in normal life to be funny. It's more like an attitude, right? It's just like when things go wrong, you take sort of a light attitude towards it. You can make the slightest little joke because humor is primarily social. This guy, Robert Provine, is a psychologist. Just came out with a book called Curious Behavior about yawning and laughing and all sorts of things. And before that, he had a book on laughter in which he went out and recorded conversations of people talking every time they laughed. And people laughed an enormous amount of the time. You know, people who are friends, when you're just talking today with people in the studio and stuff, you'll see there's a lot of laughter. But if you actually looked at what they're laughing at, it's like the world's worst sitcom. it's not really great jokes.
How do you make that distinction for the New Yorker? I know that for but just about everybody I know who reads the New Yorker first rushes through it and checks out the cartoons. What is that fine distinction?
Well, because there's a difference between you had to be there humor,
mm-hmm.
where somebody spills a glass of water. And I mean, a lot of humor is simply in normal life is, something that seems like it's a little bit bad, but turns out to be trivial. The waiter drops the dish. Somebody gets out. Let's say you're on an elevator and you're with somebody and they get out on the wrong floor. Everybody will laugh. Oh, they'll laugh. They'll say a little something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, not enough coffee this morning or whatever. And that's sort of how humor functions as a way just to relieve the tensions and little sort of what I call the hitches and glitches in life, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for a cartoon, you actually have to create something more, let's say I'll give you a few radio cartoons. Let's say in a cartoon where the title is French Army Knife and it has all corkscrews. Okay.
right.
Now, so there was something to get. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
There was something to understand. There was something to bring together sort of two different areas of associations that you usually don't bring together. And I think that's sort of the hallmark of the New Yorker cartoon. Or let's say you have a marriage counselor. And in front of the marriage counselor are a dog and a cat, but they're not really dogs and cats. They're sort of dog and cat people. You know what I mean? They're dressed in like people. And the cat, who's the man, is saying, well, we're fighting like, well, you know, and he stops. Well, we know they're fighting like dogs and cats, right? So it became a joke because the expressed idea didn't go, had you inferred something. Or a cartoon can highlight, a human truth. There's a Raj Chass cartoon where there's a guy who's looking at the obituaries. And all the obituaries say 2 years older than you, 3 years younger than you, your age right on the dot. And so that, we put these different frames to reference. Clearly, that's not what an obituary really is. And yet that's how we, that's our narcissistic way that we look at it. Or in a cartoon of mine, it's my best-known cartoon, which is a guy is looking at his appointment book, an important executive. He's on the phone, and he's saying, no, Thursday's out. How about never? Is never good for you?
I remember that one, and I was trying to figure out what was your – I know you drew the – your cartoon was the most popular or successful of all time.
We don't have records going all the way back to the Charles Adams years, but certainly that cartoon was done in 1993. And it's been reprinted thousands of times. And it's now sort of used as a catchphrase that almost as though it's an anonymous aphorism. Just people saying, how about never? Is never good for you? Essentially when they want to brush people off. Nancy Pelosi was recently on the Jon Stewart show, and I think Stewart asked her something like, well, when would you think the Republicans were really going to cooperate with Obama? And she said, how about never?
Okay.
So I mean, to get a little wonky, for biologists or psychologists call stimuli that are over and above supernormal. So to be a joke, you have to sort of raise it out of what it would be ordinary, and because it's got to act in a very different way. All humor is basically social. Laughter occurs 30 times more often with people than by yourself. People rarely laugh alone. I mean, they'll laugh at a TV show and whatever. But when they're looking at a cartoon, they are alone. So it's got to be a much stronger, cleverer, more interesting observation than you would normally make. So for me to convert, I do look for things that are funny as I'm going around and thinking, how might I convert it into a cartoon? So, and I don't know how this will be a cartoon yet, but a number of places I've been, when you're asking someone to do something, I was just at Best Buy, and before that I was at Rent-A-Car, and each time, it was taking a long time, and the person each time said, the computer system is very slow today. And I thought, has anybody ever heard when it was fast?
Right.
On the other side, did anybody in your life ever say, oh, excuse us, I'm sorry I did that so quickly. The computer system's really fast today.
Right.
So I would try to, that could be a stand-up, but I would try to figure that out. You know what I'm saying? And one of the ways you do it is you just observe. You sort of just look around and talking about kidding around, I can't make anything that I joke around in a cartoon. But so the other day I was at Starbucks, and it was weird because I was like, it was really early, and I was pretty much the only person there. And I asked for, a latte or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And they asked me for my name. I said, well, I'm the only one here. No, we need your name. You know, because you know, because they're like everybody else. They everybody plays a role. The Starbucks people play a role, and that's what they've been told. You know, we need your name. So I said to them, I said, Steve, but that's not my real name. Is that okay?
I think of some guy crawling through the desert to an oasis, and they ask him what his name is while they put him on hold.
Right.
Does everybody have a New Yorker cartoon in them, do you think? At least one?
And most people should keep it in them.
Right. Well, it's kind of interesting.
Well,
if I were Johnny Carson or, you know, whoever, someone famous that sends you a cartoon, you're going to look at it right away, right? But if it's just me...
No, actually, when Norman Mailer came to show me cartoons, he did drawings, and eventually it was published in a book called Modest Gifts, Richard, because he's Norman Mailer, which is a very aptly titled book, indeed were modest gifts. They were terrible. They weren't really cartoons. They were more like little squiggles of people's faces than normal male writing stuff. And I said, Mr. Mailer, even if these were good, that's because I'm from Queens and a little bit snotty. I said, we couldn't publish them because all anyone would think was that this is something Norman Mailer drew. So I look, and we look at every single cartoon that's sent in. But if you send in a single cartoon, you might as well stamp amateur on it.
Uh-huh.
Because it's the same thing. Like, okay, you have your radio show, right? And you come up with ideas for your show, right, or thing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't come up with one idea, right? You talk to people and you say, oh, what about this? You reject a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
The hallmark of a professional is not what they accept, but what they reject. And I think the difference between a professional in any area and an amateur, pretty much, is that a professional is generally unhappy with their work. An amateur is very pleased. So I think that's it. But we look at everything. But if you have one cartoon, it's usually going to be, let me say something else. It's like when people say, well, how do you get good ideas? Where do you get good ideas is they're getting a lot of bad ideas, a lot of ideas and throwing out the bad ones.
Right. It's killing babies.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, just shutting them up anyway.
My guest is Robert Mankoff. He's cartoon editor for The New Yorker. He'll be in town tonight if you want more information about that. You can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. He'll return when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Hi, this is Fred Anderle. Join me this Sunday for Conversations About Faith. We'll learn more about the experience of faith in God with Christian contemplative Marcia Sinitar. We'll discover what people mean when they say they are spiritual but not religious with theology professor Linda Mercadante. And we'll talk with neurosurgeon Eben Alexander. He says that while in a coma, he had a personal experience of God and heaven. Conversations About Faith, Sunday at 3 on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins. Consider the variations on the theme of the Nativity. That discussion from 11 till noon here on 89.7 NPR News. And it's a perennial NPR favorite where acclaimed authors explore Hanukkah stories. Listen to Hanukkah Lights 2012, Saturday night at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. 34 degrees with some sunshine, a high of 48 today. Rain likely late tonight, a low of 43, and rain likely on Friday, a high of 55. Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners, investment managers, providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life, at sherringtongroup.com. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. My guest is Robert Mankoff. He's cartoon editor for The New Yorker. Robert, has the recent, well, it's not very recent, but the ongoing ill will, the political chasm, I guess, the polarization of American politics been good or bad for cartooning?
Well, anything that's bad is good for humor, provided it's not tragic, you know. And, I mean, obviously it's been great for Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, Bill Maher, and, you know, I think it makes it easier to cartoon polarization because you, you have metaphors like physical cliff. You have humor. An important component of humor is conflict. You don't have any cartoons about happy marriages. Okay, you only have cartoons about bad marriage. You only have cartoons about conflict. You know, Mark Twain said the secret source of humor is not joy but sorrow. He said there's no laughter in heaven. So, fortunately for cartoonists, there's no heaven down here on earth. especially when it comes to politics. I mean, and this has been going on forever. I once did a cartoon where the newscast was saying the sun rose over Capitol Hill today, receiving broad bipartisan support. Okay. That's the only thing that would receive broad bipartisan support.
Have you ever discovered a great talent?
A great talent?
Yeah.
Oh, well, yes. Well, see, I became cartoon editor in 1997, and since then, you know, I mean, the cartoons tend to be somewhat anonymous, but I think if you look in the New Yorker magazine now, you will see about half the cartoons are made by people in their from 20 to 40 who weren't doing cartoons when I became cartoon editor. We have a guy, Zach Cannon, who does fantastic cartoons, who also writes for Saturday Night Live. And you just have to look at the cartoons. You know, you said you look at the cartoons. Well, look, you say, gee, wow. Who, you know, if you looked 15 years ago, you wouldn't see it. You know, great talent, you know, great's overused. I'll settle for good. And they're good. they're good enough for The New Yorker, which is actually pretty good.
What do you make of the Comedy Channel and the likes of Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart, who really they're pretty recent in the you know, annals of humor? What do you make of what they do?
Well, I think what they do is very good. I think you with people like Colbert and Stewart, people. There have always been people who are very funny. You know, basically have really good comedy chops, the ability to be funny. You know, going back to comedians, whether it was, you know, Jack Benny or George Burns or, you know, all those sort of classic comedians. And they were intelligent people, too, but they weren't educated. They hadn't gone to college. So there was very little political satire. Probably Mort Saul was the first stand-up comedian who does that in the late 50s. You know, Lenny Bruce then is political in his own way, as though also taking on issues that first comedians have talked about, dealing with all sorts of things about society and sexuality or whatever. And then you have a whole generation of people who are very talented comedically, very smart, and also educated at very good schools. I mean, you know, the guy I mentioned before, Zach Cannon, was president of the Harvard Lampoon. So you have now people who got interested in comedy who had gone to Harvard or Princeton or Yale or Brown, I think, in the case of Jon Stewart. So they're able to be really conversant on more than a superficial level with the issues. So Jon Stewart can be funny, and he's very funny himself. And also his staff is drawn from this same pool of educated and comically talented people. Of course, and so I think it's generally a good thing. I mean, more than generally, it's a good thing. the idea that most people get their news from fake news, I don't think most people actually do. You can't really enjoy deeply or in an interesting way Stewart or Colbert, really, unless you actually know something about the topic.
There's been a lot in the news lately about how North Koreans responded to a recent proclamation in The Onion that Kim Jong-il, their leader, is the sexiest man, I think the sexiest man alive or something like that. And they took it seriously. And one North Korean state publication devoted something like 55 pages to photographs of their leader to prove that point. It's hard to imagine, but not everybody gets American humor.
Well, it's clearly the North Korean stuff.
Is that?
And I don't think they add into our hip hop either.
I don't know.
You know what you don't actually. I would think that there is in these fiercely totalitarian societies, usually there is an undercurrent of subversive humor going on.
Uh-huh.
You know. That we wouldn't even know about. I would think that I don't know the extent. Remember, people try to escape from North Korea too.
Right.
So it's easier to look at it monolithically and to take their actual propaganda in their publication as thinking that the North Korean people think it. And really, if he's the sexiest man alive, if they think he's dead, then they're going to have a severe population deficit in the coming years.
Oh, I guess it was a Chinese publication. It wasn't a North Korean publication.
Really, Chinese? I heard that.
I'm being corrected.
Well, but you don't have very good humor in societies which are monolithic, because humor does depend on difference. Some heterogeneity, you know, and even your sense, you need in societies that are very homogeneous, you don't have very much humor being used in social interactions. You have more politeness takes that role. Here, because we have people of all different backgrounds and we don't know what other people's agendas are, or what they're thinking, we tend to smooth things over with a joke rather than a bow.
Nancy in Columbus, you're on the air with Robert Mankoff. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Thank you. You don't know how much The New Yorker has meant to me. In 1976, I think it was, my father gave me a subscription to The New Yorker. And those cartoons, I remember copying my favorite ones and putting them in a book. I remember one, there were two business-looking men, bald-headed men, they were in the clouds with wings. Halos.
Yeah.
And one angel says to the other one, I had hate in my heart for doctors and lawyers, but apparently that was okay. And I remember another one, two women sitting in a big restaurant at the table, and one says to the other one, I got what I wanted, but it wasn't what I expected.
That's wonderful.
And over the years, reading Thurber cartoons, William Wyndham was an old-time friend of mine, and he died this summer, and I loved him. And his second show, Thurber One, it was the Essays of the Casuals, but the second one was the cartoons. And sometimes in our weekly conversations, we would just talk about our favorite one. And I remember mine was the Thurber Woman, and she was standing at a window holding the draperies back, and she's looking over her shoulder, and she says to her husband, "Well, don't come and look at the rainbow then, you big ape."
I'll be talking about Thurber. And Thurber, well, all those cartoons are great. And they often make a point, you know, over and above just being funny. I got what I wanted, but not what I expected, or whatever. Or there's one by Barbara Smaller which said, sex brought us together, but gender drove us apart. And of course, Thurber transformed cartooning in many ways. His drawing, which I'll talk about, you know, tonight, you know, he, up until Thurber, really, cartooning had been mainly a lot of illustration. And if you look at old Punch magazines like that, Thurber sort of freed it from that because he couldn't draw that well, but he could draw funny. He did what I call good bad drawing, and we have a lot of good bad drawing, which is different than bad bad drawing. It's drawing like Raj Chast that is expressive, a personality that you know that is coherent. So the New York cartoons, I'm wondering, I'm really pleased there's a special place in your heart for them. There is for an awful lot of people, and you know, one we don't know maybe, but I founded the Cartoon Bank, which people can get prints of any New Yorker cartoon and license them for PowerPoint textbooks and whatever. So you just have to go up online and you can pretty much find any cartoon you want.
Thank you, Nancy, for your call. Oh, sorry.
Oh. Thanks.
We do still have a few minutes left with Robert Mankoff, cartoon editor for The New Yorker. If you have a question or comment for him, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I don't know if you still do it, but you were teaching and doing research as part of a new humor Michigan program?
Yeah, at University of Michigan. I'm not doing it this year. I'll probably do it again next year. This year I had a lot of things on my plate, but I did teach for a number of years a very sweet called, of course, called The Art and Science of Humor. And we did, you know, all sorts of interesting experiments on humor. There's been a lot of research into basically what's funny and why, to whom, where, and when.
And what was it, when people take that class, what's their major? I mean, what are they taking the class for? Is it a fun elective or what?
It could be a psychology majors take it. I taught it at Art and Design because of course there's a lot of art involved. Mm-hmm. Sociology, but humor is involved with all of these things. I mean, just go back, Jon Stewart. You know, ask yourself the question: why is Jon Stewart so much funnier on his show than at the Oscars?
Hmm.
Why? Why do you think? Well, because humor is social. The dynamics of humor is that in any business situation, a lot of humor depends. Social depends on willing to interrupt. Depends on the hierarchy, where you are in the hierarchy. If you gave a psychologist or a humorologist someone a tape of a board meeting. Or a meeting of people, you know, in a business, a bunch of them, in a language he didn't understand, you could very well tell by who laughs at what the hierarchy is. Very easy for the boss to get a laugh, not so much harder for someone lower on the totem pole. And Jon Stewart, besides being very talented in his show, he's the boss. You come to see him.
Mm-hmm.
At the Academy Awards, he's not the boss.
Hmm.
So it's sort of stuff like that, and there's you know, other experiments about humor theory, different theories. Like, what is it? Why is something actually funny? What's sort of the atom of it, the kernel of it? Is it surprise? Well, that does seem to be an important, you know, yeah, it does seem to be an important factor. I mean, the simplest joke, you know, for a child is peekaboo, where all of a sudden they're, you know, the mom goes away and then you show your face again, surprise. But the surprise has to be comfortable. It can't be frightening. So you can see YouTube, you know, many stuff on YouTube on this, where you'll see originally there's a slight frightened look on the child's face before they laugh. A lot of jokes work that way. Right before you get the joke,
Yes. You're
puzzled and a little worried.
Well,
right? And then you understand it.
Well,
I just gave you the whole course. You don't have.
Yeah, no, sometimes I don't get a cartoon in The New Yorker, and I can't give you an example right now, but I was thinking about this morning. It's true, and it's hard to admit that to you. It almost seems like an IQ test that I failed.
Well, yeah, that's why we ran a feature in the cartoon issue periodically called I Don't Get It, The New Yorker Cartoon IQ Test. Sometimes you get it.
Did you really?
Yeah. Where we give like the three right wrong answers and the one right one, and you know, a number of the cartoons, you know, can be puzzling. I mean, Thurber's cartoons were like that when you actually think about it. I mean, a lot of people they weren't exactly the type of cartoons you can get. You know, his famous one where there's a seal over the bed, you know, and and when we're saying you have it your own way, you heard a seal bark. Well, that sounds like a straight joke, right? What's a seal doing there? Really, that's a weird joke. For that could be one of our caption contest jokes. There could be a million different lines for that. And where the cartoon where there's a couple, and then there's a man and there's a woman up high up on the bookcase. And he's saying something like, that's the first Miss Williamson, up there. But what is she doing there? That's not, many people will find that funny. Many people will just be puzzled by it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Completely puzzled. And if it wasn't Thurber, if all of a sudden you saw a cartoon like that in the New Yorker today, you'd be saying, what is that? I mean, it's a type of sort of inspired silliness when it works. And it's the difference between, needing complete closure and like, I get it, like in one of our caption contests, there's a board meeting and there's parrots on everybody's shoulder. Okay. And so one of the answers to the caption contest was, one guy saying to the other, Dave, we've got to think of a better way to record our meetings. Now you can get that cartoon, right? You understand parrots mm-hmm. talk, right? Okay. And another caption was, shut up, Bob. Everybody knows your parrot's a clip-on. Well, that's weirder, right?
Yes.
Well, are parrots clip-ons? I mean, it like assumes a whole other universe. So you could see where, one of the tests of this type of stuff is, could you explain this to someone in a foreign country?
Hmm.
You see what I mean? They would sort of be puzzled. They say, I don't understand. In your country, you wear parrots as accessories. See, it sort of assumes a whole other thing. So that was one of the things Thurber did. He opened up a much looser, zanier type of humor. Like I once did a cartoon, not necessarily inspired by Thurber, but for that type of humor where there's a guy in front of a table, all different objects are on it, and he's saying, and the title is, all you need is a bicycle, pump, an ordinary deck of playing cards, and a pair of Gucci loafers, and you're ready to begin.
Robert Mankoff, we have to call it off right now. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay. Robert, all right. Thank you.
Thank you. Robert Mankoff will be in Columbus tonight if you want to know where, at the Thurber House. Go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. He is the cartoon editor for The New Yorker. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.